Over 5 years after Hurricane Katrina, author Jordan Flaherty's book, Floodlines, provides grassroots insight and information on local struggles waged by the people of New Orleans to address the immediate crisis during the storm and long-term community-based struggles to bring justice to the victims of the disaster. Floodlines is a book on community building and resistance in New Orleans. Images of hurricane victims stranded on rooftops amidst rising waters or New Orleans residents facing police violence are widely known, while the stories of the people of New Orleans organizing for justice after the storm are rarely told. Struggles for an end to police violence and access to quality public education. In December 2010, a former New Orleans police officer was sentenced to 8 years in prison for a police shooting of a flood victim in New Orleans in the weeks after the storm. This interview with author Jordan Flaherty provides perspective on the case and details the role that grassroots campaigning played in bringing the cases of police shootings of New Orleans residents after the storm, both to the courts and to the media's attention. Author Jordan Flaherty presents New Orleans post-Katrina from the grassroots perspective. Floodlines is a publication that tells the story of New Orleans not from the halls of power, but from the streets. I had the opportunity to speak with Jordan Flaherty about his recently released book, Floodlines, and his reflections on Hurricane Katrina 5 years after the storm. So we're sitting with author Jordan Flaherty here in Montreal. You've recently released a book, Floodlines, that looks at community struggles and resistance in New Orleans 5 years after Katrina. So maybe to start, if you could offer some reflections on your book for an audience here in Canada. I know that in the United States, Katrina and the struggles of people in New Orleans were widely broadcast. We watched it from a bit of a distance here in Canada. Maybe talk about some of the key issues or stories that you're attempting to highlight with your book.
Well, I think in general, if you look at U.S. policy around healthcare, education, criminal justice, in some ways it's a dystopian future for Canada. Many of these policies that have been tried out in the U.S. are also exported. And then, of course, many policies that the U.S. tries to export through structural adjustment programs, IMF and World Bank, it's now bringing home to the U.S. So you're seeing this back and forth between different countries and different strategies for trying to push through privatization, corporatization, militarization, criminalization. So, for example, in New Orleans, all of these issues, housing, education, healthcare, criminal justice, we saw them on hyperspeed. There's struggles over the role of education, the role of privatization in education, the role of teachers' unions, the power and strength of the teachers. But in New Orleans, we had overnight 7,500 teachers, the entire staff of the public school system, fired. We had the whole school system change over from a system that was under control of the local school board to now a system that's under what we call charter schools or under state control being shifted over to charter schools and what the school superintendent calls the first 100% free market public school system in the U.S. So we saw these changes happen remarkably fast. In criminal justice, the first city function to restart was the city jail, that they transformed bus station into the city jail. You saw prisoners left behind as the waters were rising and then shipped up to upstate prisons like Angola Prison, a former slave plantation where it's estimated 97% of the population there will die there. You had our public hospital was immediately shut down. You had 80% of our housing was damaged. The public housing was mostly undamaged, but it was boarded up by people in power who tried to take that opportunity. Congressman Richard Baker of the Baton Rouge area said, "We've been trying to do something about public housing. We couldn't, but God did." So people in power took advantage of the situation to push forward these rapid reforms on all of these issues.
mean, you're really talking about broad changes across the social structure of New Orleans, but maybe expand more on the way that this crisis, I mean, if we want to look at, you know, the well-known theory, Naomi Klein also speaks about your book, the shock doctrine theory. What was the reality of hypercapitalism in New Orleans? I mean, you talked about these specific examples, but maybe let's talk about schools, the rapid firing of the public school teachers. What did that mean for communities struggling to cope with the massive devastation?
Well, certainly Naomi Klein's framing of this, her Shock Doctrine book, has been a really important way for helping to look at this and what we faced. With the teachers, that teachers' union that they were a member of was the largest union in the city. It was 80% African American, so it was the largest source of middle class black political power in the city. And so it ceased to exist after Katrina. The teachers were all fired. The union ceased to exist. Basically, what you had with the school system is a school system that was already in trouble pre-Katrina, but you had two different views over what was wrong with the school system. Many community members thought that the problem was a lack of funding, a lack of opportunity, bad pay for teachers, crumbling infrastructure. But then there were those in power that thought that the problem was too much power for the teachers' union, too much local control. So they took advantage of this storm to completely wrest the school system out of local control, to seize the school system. And so firing the teachers, getting rid of the teachers' union, taking the schools out of control of the school board, this was all their plan of how they wanted to try out their experiments. They saw this as a blank slate. They openly spoke of the New Orleans school system as a blank slate. As poet and educator and civil rights activist Kalamu Yassalam has said, it wasn't a blank slate, it was a graveyard, and they're experimenting over people's bones. Civil rights lawyer Tracy Washington said, when I think of experiments, I think of Tuskegee, notorious experiment on African Americans in the 20th century that, again, was done without their consent. And that's, I think, one of the most painful things for people from New Orleans, the ways in which these reforms were pushed through without any desire to get any kind of consent from the parents, from the teachers, from the students. This was all done with no inclination to consult with the people most affected.
Well, there's the basic story of New Orleans that was widely critiqued, which was the lack of government, state response on a national level to the disaster. That's a very apparent critique. It's widely spoken about globally. This whole other reality of the post-hurricane reforms and the shock treatment, the hyper-capitalism, is a whole nother layer. Why do you feel it's not as immediately apparent?
For example, still staying on the schools, there's a lot of forces that want to see this change happen in the school system nationwide. There's a massive push for charters happening in the U.S. right now. You see this new film that came out called Waiting for Superman by the director of the Al Gore documentary An Inconvenient Truth, where they're really trying to push for these charter schools. And you see an interesting coalition on these charter schools. There's some progressive people that are involved in them that see them as a way of bring community control to school systems, and they can be that. But then you also have, I think, a lot of privatizers that are also very cynically using charters as a backdoor towards privatization of the public school system. So you have these kind of strange bedfellows that are happening in the system, and you have these forces arrayed behind this push for charter schools, where you have, in New Orleans, for example, city government, state government, and federal government, and then all of these private foundations, the Gates Foundation, the Walton Foundation. Many of the major billionaires of this country are behind this push for charter schools. Oprah Winfrey just gave $1 million to a charter school in New Orleans. The head of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, just gave $100 million to charter schools in New Jersey. You're seeing the wealthy elites putting massive amount of resources into this push. And oftentimes, integral to that push is breaking the teachers' unions, breaking the power of the teachers' unions, breaking local control. And often, but not always, an integral part of that push is how can we make profit off of it? How can we use this as a step towards privatization?
Back to post-Katrina, it seems like a lot of policies placed on New Orleans after the hurricane really revolved around profit. So we talked about schools, but maybe go back and expand on what the hurricane meant for public housing and other elements of the public life in New Orleans. And how did that reshaping of policy affect people power?
Well, again, on housing, it is a part of a nationwide movement in the U.S. where they're trying to destroy this very idea of a right to housing or even a right to affordable housing or even the availability of affordable housing. So, for example, in Atlanta, all of the public housing is now gone. There's no more public housing in the city. In New Orleans, almost all of it is gone. And in New Orleans, it happened after Katrina. This housing was some of the best built housing in the city. It was mostly undamaged. 80% of the housing in the city was damaged by the flooding, but the public housing was mostly undamaged. And yet, people in power put gates over that housing and used it to keep those people from coming back. And that was one of many obstacles that kept the people displaced from the city from coming back. There's now at least 100,000 people from New Orleans. They're not able to come back. Our former population was about 470,000. The current population is 355,000. Some number of that 355,000 are people that didn't live there pre-Katrina. So well over 100,000 have been displaced. The only study that I've seen found that 75% of African Americans who used to live in New Orleans want to come back, but feel that they've been kept out mostly because of economic means, whether it's because they were in public housing and that housing is now closed, or because they owned a home but they didn't receive the money to rebuild, or because their job no longer exists. So these economic measures have literally kept people from returning, and it certainly disproportionately affected poor folks, but it also, again, if you look at the example of the teachers, which is a middle to upper class, but mostly African American base, it disproportionately affected African Americans across class boundaries.
Relay some of the human stories that you project in your book. I mean, if we talk about the displacement, 100,000 people unable to return to their city, what did this mean? Talk about some of the people that you worked with.
You know, one of the things that makes me saddest in this period is so many of the incredible people who the city needs so much who have been kept from returning. Sunny Patterson is an amazing poet, spoken word artist, social justice activist, teacher. To many people, she is the voice of New Orleans. If you listen to almost any poet in New Orleans, they have some influence. You can feel Sunny Patterson's words in their words. You can see that they grew up listening to her. She's an amazing, incredible poet. She came back after Katrina, but then found that she, between trying to help her family rebuild their home, trying to pay the rents that had gone up in some neighborhoods 100%, she was just no longer able to stay in the city. And now she's displaced into Houston, along with tens of thousands of other former New Orleanians. And talking to her, she can't even believe the words. As she says Houston, she's like, it just doesn't even sound right to say it. Houston, Houston, you know. She loves New Orleans so much, but wasn't able to come back. Sharonda Thomas, another brilliant organizer, community activist, grew up in the Ninth Ward of New Orleans. Her entire family lived in New Orleans going back generations. And we so much needed organizers like her in the rebuilding. But her entire family was displaced to Houston. She had two small kids, and she really needed that extended family to help look after her kids, you know, while she was working. And so she wasn't able to come back on her own. You know, I tried to even find her work and housing in the city, but without her family able to come back, she wasn't able to come back. So it's just so painful to me, those people that really deserve to be in New Orleans that aren't. And then here I am, a white, recent resident of New Orleans. I moved there a few years before the storm. And for me, it was much easier to be there. And that's part of the story of New Orleans, that many of the people who had been there for generations found it much harder to come back. And many people who had just moved there after the storm, found it much easier.
You said you had arrived a few years before the storm. Describe the feeling on the streets. Has it changed? What's the difference when you walk in the city 2 years or prior to the hurricane, the storm, and afterwards?
Well, some areas like the French Quarter, the business district where the hotels are, the Garden District, those areas have changed very little. They didn't receive much flooding, and they received a disproportionate share of rebuilding money. So they were pretty okay. But then if you look at former residential African-American neighborhoods like the Lower Ninth Ward, Gentilly, New Orleans East, you can feel the emptiness, the absence. In the area of the Lower Ninth Ward, near where the main levee break was, it used to be thousands of people living there, block after block of houses, a full residential neighborhood, more than 50% home ownership, 98% African-American, working class to middle class neighborhood. Now there's, in that area by the levee break, maybe 15 to 20 houses, and the rest is overgrown weeds, so high sometimes you can't see stop signs. Occasionally you'll see steps leading up to a home that's no longer there. You'll see the foundation for a home that again is gone. The homes were washed away and then subsequently demolished. Ironically, some of the only homes in that neighborhood were built by Brad Pitt, who started a program to help people come back, and he built a few dozen homes near that area. And those are some of the only homes there. If not for Brad Pitt, there'd be almost no homes in that area at all, which is so painful to look at and to see and to walk through.
What do you think the post-disaster reality in New Orleans speaks to in terms of the American reality today, economically and politically? What are some of the deep issues that the reality today speaks to?
Well, I think this period gets at the heart of these struggles around all these issues. But I don't want to paint it as just problems, as just dystopian, because although there has been all of that and all those terrible, heartbreaking problems, there's also been incredible organizing and incredible grassroots resistance. And that's part of why I thought it was so important to write this book and to try in whatever way I could to get these stories out. Because I do think, as much as there are warnings for anyone in the case example of New Orleans, there's also inspiring, important, beautiful organizing. You know, the fact that so many people have returned against these odds, that hundreds of thousands of people fought, as one organizer said, you know, they've underestimated the determination of people like myself to fight for our last breath to come back to this city. And that's what we've seen in the city, is people fighting and struggling and winning some real concrete victories on these issues, especially on the issue of police violence. People struggled for years against a wall of official silence and against incredible police brutality. But, you know, now we're actually seeing changes. They want a complete reform over the indigent defense system. They won an independent monitor over the police department. They've won Justice Department intervention charges against dozens of officers, 9 ongoing investigations with more sure to come. And this happened because of people at the grassroots that refused to be silent and refused to stop fighting.
If you look at the city historically, a lot of the things that are cherished culturally about New Orleans, culturally, they're linked to a history of struggle, the history of jazz and blues and the African-American experience. What does New Orleans speak to today in terms of like the culture of resistance?
It's a crucial part of this story, absolutely crucial. It's in many ways a culture of resistance. The very history of these art forms of jazz funerals, social aid and pleasure clubs, Mardi Gras Indians, these very specific African-American community institutions and cultural institutions that are basically unique to New Orleans, came about because of a community using a culture to resist a dominant white supremacist culture. That's really where these things came out of. Throughout the African-American community of New Orleans, we have these institutions called social aid and pleasure clubs. These are Black community institutions that were formed in the Reconstruction era, the late 19th century, as both a vehicle to preserve the culture and as a organization to help to benefit the community, to provide insurance for people in the community, to buy books for kids at school. That's the root of these. And they also were the vehicle that preserved jazz funerals, second lines, which are these roving street parades, parties, barbecue festival, all rolled into one that we have every weekend in the city, with anywhere from 1 to 6 brass bands and anywhere from a few hundred to several thousand people completely taking over the street in a swarm of dancing. This incredible tradition, you know, really came about as a form of resistance. Even the roots of much of the more modern musical traditions of hip-hop, what we call bounce music in New Orleans, that was preserved through the Block Party, which came about mostly in the poor neighborhoods. It was called project music, so it came from the housing projects. And the Block Party started because one person on the block couldn't make their rent. And so the community would have this party, you know, where everyone would come together and pay a couple dollars, and that money would go to help that person pay the rent. You know, so it came about organizing for the aid of community, and the culture was preserved and the music was amplified and multiplied through this vehicle that was also about social aid.
It seems like the narrative of New Orleans could take two tracks. There's a narrative of how power, political, economic power in the United States has dealt with crisis and displacement, enforced power structures nationally, locally, state power structures, administering the post-disaster reality. That's one narrative. There's another narrative in your book, which is completely 180 of that whole framework of what went down. So maybe talk about those two competing narratives.
It's not just about these two potential destinies for New Orleans, but really about two potential tracks for social movements around the country. I really believe that this will be mirrored in other struggles, and not just in the U.S., but internationally. I think that there's absolutely lessons for this for Canada. I think you're already seeing the players in this continue to move on to other countries. You know, if you look at the Haiti earthquake, many of the corporations that were immediately profiting off the Katrina also tried to profit off of the Haiti earthquake. Many of the same top-down, unaccountable NGOs like Red Cross were, of course, as always, the first to start being on the scene in Haiti. Even our school superintendent, Paul Vallis, who worked on this changing of the school system in New Orleans, was brought in to advise in Haiti and was brought in to advise in Chile after the earthquake there. So you're seeing these same players again and again, the criminalization of the people of New Orleans after Katrina. You know, you saw suddenly the media depiction change from people were victims, people were survivors, to suddenly people were criminals, they were looters, they were armed gangs. And you absolutely saw that same media depiction of people in Haiti after the earthquake, this criminalization of the survivors, this militarization of the relief, the bringing in of U.S. troops in both situations. So I think we really need to learn these lessons from New Orleans and from Katrina for the next situation. I think that this system that we live in, disasters are an intrinsic part of the system and they're inevitable, and we need to learn the lessons and learn how we can continue to struggle and continue to respond effectively.
Last question. You're touring now. You're carrying these stories with you. They're in the book, but also in your heart and your mind. When you're touring around, what's the feeling being here, talking to people? Why was it important for you to go out?
You know, before Katrina, I actually didn't identify as a journalist or as a writer. I'd done a little bit of writing, but what happened was I was in New Orleans when the storm happened and then wrote about my experiences and what I saw and about how the reality on the ground was so different from the way the media was depicting people of New Orleans. And that initial writing that I did was forwarded around the world and was translated into several languages. And organizers that I really respected in New Orleans asked me to keep doing this, to keep trying to uplift these grassroots stories that weren't being told. And so to me, traveling around and trying to bring this book around, trying to bring these stories, is just trying to further amplify these voices. I don't want my voice to be a substitution for African-American voices from New Orleans, but I'm trying to amplify and multiply those voices and trying to help support those struggles and to support the lessons from those struggles being learned. And it's been absolutely incredible traveling around and connecting with organizers and activists around the country and seeing how these struggles are the same and how people are facing many of the same obstacles, not just in terms of police or privatizers or corporations, but also in terms of the very structural problems that we have with our movement. In the U.S. especially, we have, you know, what's called the nonprofit industrial complex and the ways in which movements have become accountable to corporate funders or foundation funders rather than to their constituency. I've also just connected with people doing incredible resistance. Latina parents in Chicago who were doing a 24-hour sit-in in a school building there to resist the city's plans to take those school building and sell it to a private school. Organizing around police brutality in Pittsburgh, a march of thousands of people against police brutality in Pittsburgh, to travel around and see how these same issues are coming up and people are struggling around these same issues in the country. It really drives home the importance of learning these lessons and of building unity in our movements.
You have been listening to an interview with author Jordan Flaherty on Floodlines, a recently released book on New Orleans that tells the story of people struggling to survive after Hurricane Katrina. Flaherty focuses on the stories of grassroots community activists struggling for justice, for the right to housing, for public education, and a New Orleans free of police violence after the wave of police shootings of flood victims in New Orleans after Katrina. For more information on Floodlines and the writings of Jordan Flaherty, visit floodlines.org. That's floodlines.org. This interview was produced for broadcast on CKUT Radio in Montreal by Stefan Christophe.